to the work session for the City of Cedar Hills. Today is Wednesday, December 7th, 2016. I currently have 6:04 p.m. I'd like to call our work session to order. Tonight we have on the agenda a discussion regarding the water quality issues of American Fort Canyon. We have some friends from Division of Water Quality that are here, Kim Shelley, Scott Daly, is that correct? Scott Daly, thank you. And so they're going to make a presentation on what's going on at the canyon, water quality and all of that. Recently, Mr. Geddes, Mr. Crawley, and I sat down with representatives of Snowbird where they talked about tests that they're making on the water and how they're proceeding. And I just thought it would be a good idea to hear from DEQ to talk about all things about water quality. I'll set the table a little bit and just establish Cedar Hills gets all of its culinary water from wells. So we don't get any of our drinking water out of American Fort Canyon. However, we all get our water from a common aquifer and water table. And so we're curious as to, with any development that takes place up in American Fort Canyon, could that affect our wells and our water quality? And the water that we do get from American Fort Canyon directly goes into our pressurized irrigation system. It's not that much, but we do get it, and we stop getting it around the end of June. So just kind of setting the table with that. And so who's going first, Kim or Scott? Scott's going to go first.
Well, thanks for having us down. I appreciate the opportunity. We'll just go. Again, I'm Scott Daly with the Division of Water Quality. So I'm the Utah Lake Watershed Coordinator for the Division. So I'm coordinating a couple of water quality studies on Utah Lake, do a lot of the watershed management stuff, responsibilities for the Division. So my involvement, I've been involved with the Tibble Fork and somewhat with Snowbird throughout the summer. So today, I guess I thought meeting purpose, you know, we just come and give you a general idea of water quality conditions throughout the American Fort Canyon and how we go about making our water quality determinations. I'll talk a little bit about the mining activity that has occurred in the past in the canyon and then what that really means for water quality and some of the issues and risks that we might have because of it. We'll talk a little bit about the Tibble Fork release from this summer. The Division was heavily involved in that effort. And then we'll get into some of our involvement with Snowbird. And then recently, it's a new to us issue. The Environmental Protection Agency recently declared that they will be doing a preliminary assessment on the American Fork River in context of the CERCLA program. And I'll define that for you later on in the presentation.
Could you explain what the CERCLA program is?
Yeah, so essentially it's Superfund. It's the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act.
So is this in light of the Tibble Fork runoff situation?
So it is not, actually.
It's not, okay.
It's more to deal with the historic mining that's present in the canyon.
Very good.
Okay, so for general water quality conditions, the way the Division conducts its work for water quality, it's really guided by the Utah Water Quality Act, and which is an extension of the Federal Clean Water Act. And so that mandates us to take a stepwise approach to first establish beneficial uses for all water bodies in the state. So what's the water used for? Is it for fishing, recreation, agriculture, and those kinds of things? And then we develop standards to protect those uses, employ a monitoring program to be able to evaluate if we're meeting the standards, and then develop corrective action plans, essentially, to be able to mitigate any of the deficiencies that we see. So for the American Fork drainage, we have a number of different assessment units, five of them here. American Fork River 1, and it's interesting that they're not numbered in order of how they occur in the watershed. But we have from the mouth of the canyon to Tibble Fork Reservoir, and we have from Tibble Fork Reservoir up to the headwaters. And these include all the tributaries that flow into Tibble Fork or into the American Fork River along the way. We have an assessment unit that goes from Utah Lake to the mouth of the canyon. It's kind of a narrow strip that follows. I'll show you a map where these are located. And then we have two assessment units, one for the Tibble Fork Reservoir and one for Silver Lake Flat Reservoir, to allow us to do our lake sampling protocols. And so for the canyon, you can see the use classes on the right. I have 2B, 3A, and 4, and those are defined down below here. 2B, and this is our infrequent contact recreation. So we assume that there's a low likelihood of ingestion of water, so there'd be a low risk of being of a person getting sick from ingesting water. That's compared to a 2A, which is a high frequency use, so things like water skiing or swimming where you're doing triathlons and stuff like that. So for the canyon, we consider this an infrequent contact recreation, so people wading, fishermen, and those kinds of things. The uses are designated for cold water species of game fish and then their associated food web. You'll notice that the American Fork, that the assessment unit from the lake to the mouth of the canyon is actually designated for warm water fishery, so it's a little bit different use where we assume that there's different species of fish. And then for the agricultural use, of course, where it's protected, or we have standards to protect for irrigation use or stock water use.
Question?
Sure.
And do you assess the water quality in other areas such as Little Silver or Pittsburgh Lake?
Not regularly. We've been up to areas like Forest Lake that I know in the last 5 or 6, 7 years. I don't know about Forest Lake personally. This map actually shows some detail of where all the monitoring locations that we've ever established throughout the canyon. Came up a little darker than I thought. There's a number up in the Mineral Basin area and along that upper stretch of the North Fork, but I don't know about Pittsburgh Lake specifically. So these sites have been established by a number of groups, a lot of them by the Division of Water Quality, and then a number to support some sampling that occurred in the 90s and early 2000s to kind of get the first round of investigation on the mine contamination issues that they were dealing with up around Miller Hill and up in the upper stretches of Mineral Basin on the North Fork. The table on the left here just kind of shows the sites that we have visited most recently since 2001. And we have a partner in the Timp Cave Monument. They monitor a couple springs in there up on the, near the cave regularly and report that data to us. And then the bulk of the work beyond that is to support the lake monitoring program, and then there's a few river monitoring locations. So like I mentioned, the next step for us after establishing beneficial uses is to do the monitoring. And so we have a monitoring program establishing these sites. For this particular watershed, it's part of our Utah Lake Watershed Management Area. We have 6 of these areas throughout the state. And so we implement what we call a targeted basin or rotating basin monitoring program, where we visit one of those 6 monitoring areas every year and then come back to that one on the 7th year. So for this basin, our intensive basin monitoring is planned for the water year beginning in October of 2017, so next year. And we begin that process with the dark blue box here, which is what we call our probabilistic monitoring. And what we do is establish 50 randomly selected sites throughout the watershed, mostly characterizing kind of the upper reaches or more headwater streams. And this helps us try to prioritize sites where we think we might have problems for our intensive basin monitoring. Then the next step here is our assessment, and we'll roll that data into a report that we need to make to the EPA every 2 years. So for our 2012 and 14, we included all the data in our record up through that 2011 intensive basin monitoring. And then for 2016, the division wasn't targeting the American Fork drainage for new monitoring, so we didn't have new data from the division to report on our 2016 report. This doesn't mean that we didn't have new data. Other cooperators like the Timp Cave and the Forest Service contribute data frequently. And we will include that in our assessment. But the next time we'll include intensive basin monitoring data collected from the division will be in the 2020 integrated report. And so when we go through this report process, we compare all the water quality data that we have to the standards that we've assigned to protect those uses and make a determination on whether or not the uses are supported. So for the American Fork River 1, And for the Utah Lake to the mouth of the canyon unit, we're supporting all uses. We're able to make a full assessment and show that our recreational use, our swim, our fishery use, and our agricultural uses were all being met. And so there, it's a healthy use. For our lake sites, you'll notice that it says no evidence of impairment. What this really means is that we are not able to make a complete assessment because one piece of data might be missing. And for lakes, it's pretty common that we don't have E. coli data to be able to assess the recreational use. That's our primary parameter for assessing recreation. And then the last one here is the American Fork River 2. And so this is from Table Fork to the headwaters. And we have an insufficient data classification here. And what that means is we didn't have quite enough information to make a complete assessment or make a determination either way, whether or not they're supporting or not supporting the standards. And so I added with exceedances here. In this particular case, we had one monitoring location on the lower portion of Mary Ellen Gulch, and it has an exceedance for cadmium for the aquatic life recreation or aquatic life use. So what we'll do now is take that information and add that into our planning process for 2017 and focus on collecting more information in that intensive basin process so that we can make a full assessment and determination of the use in the future. And I'll talk a little bit about this later when we get into the snowbird portion of what they're proposing to do and their monitoring plan. And we've worked with them to help fill that data gap for the monitoring.
Question?
Sure.
So on the reservoirs where you have insufficient data, is this because of lack of budget, or is there some other reason why you haven't done E. coli monitoring?
No, well, E. coli, for one, is kind of a newer parameter that we've incorporated into our regular monitoring runs, and where we haven't had an intensive basin since 2011, that could be the reason it just hasn't been incorporated. E. coli is time-consuming for us to collect, and when you collect the sample, you need to go back five times within a month. And so in that regard, it is kind of, it's time-intensive and somewhat expensive for personnel time. We're able to more easily roll that into our stream monitoring programs just because we're visiting monthly and we're able to get the number of samples that we need to make an assessment. Okay. So, brief mining history. This body, I'm sure, is well more aware of the mining that's occurred in this watershed than I am. But just this slide to point out that extensive mining has occurred, hard rock mining for metallic minerals in the watershed. And there are implications when it comes to water quality with that kind of mining history. One of the things that we look at are the presence of tailings or spillage piles, and their ability, the potential for transporting of those tailings into live water through precipitation events or runoff, or maybe a stream is cutting through the edge of the tailing. And so there's potential for incorporating those tailings into a water body, which could impact a beneficial use of fishing or irrigation or something like that. The other component that we generally look at when we have these tunnels that are drilled into the side of the mountain, it allows presence of oxygen or air to get into the mine, and it can interact with the minerals. In particular, iron can dissociate and produce iron that you'll see distributed out in the stream in kind of that reddish color on the stream bed. And then it also pulls out a sulfur compound, which can interact with the water and then actually create sulfuric acid and will lower the pH of the water. And as you lower pH, it's able to dissolve more metals from those minerals into the water and transport them. So having those dissolved metals transported out of the mine is a concern, because once those are just transported out, pH will go up and they can be deposited into the stream bed or taken out of the dissolved fraction and left in the stream channel.
So I have a quick question and make a comment. So when I listened to Snowbird's presentation, there is a distinction between tailing piles and just slough piles, I guess. You make that distinction?
Okay, I'm not sure that I'm familiar enough with slough piles.
Is that what they refer to it? Tailing? Tailings meant that they smeltered it.
Okay.
So they're pretty chemicals. If they were just digging rock out, apparently that's different.
Okay.
Is that something you're familiar with?
That may be true. I'm not sure about the slough piles. The tailings, like this picture is the tailing, the waste rock that was taken out of the
Yankee. Yeah, that picture clearly looks like tailing because it looks like it's been processed or something.
So I'm not sure the risk with the slough piles, but I would think that, you know, the tailing piles is what one of the things
that's the concern. Yeah, that's what they said too.
And there may be an issue with the slough piles, but I'm not familiar with that enough to speak on it. And contaminants, the typical metals that we see in this and in this basin, arsenic, cadmium, copper, lead, mercury, zinc, among some others. We'll have a full list, comprehensive list, when we start talking more about the Tibble Fork release. Okay, so Tibble Fork. You know, the sediment release really came around because of the Conservancy District's project for doing dam rehabilitation and doing seismic upgrades to the dam. So there's considered to be risk if there were an earthquake of flooding downstream water users and residents. And also to kind of add back some of that storage that they've lost through sediment being deposited in the reservoir over the years. And we have some good photos on the actual amount of sediment that's been deposited from the release, and I'm sure many of you have driven up there and have seen this. So August 22nd is when we think the sediment was released. We were notified on the 23rd for our response. On the 19th, I'm sorry, the contractor began drawing down the water elevation so that they can do some work on the dam and get into some of the construction processes that they needed to. On the 22nd, they identified a large plug in the outlet works that was slowing down their ability to draw the water level down. And at one point, that plug released and caused a large spike in flow. Well, I understand the flow went from about 10 CFS or 20 CFS up to 60 CFS as a result of the release of that plug. And that excess stream energy was able to incorporate the sediments that were stored behind the dam and transport those downstream, resulting in 5,000 cubic yards or so of sediment carried out of the reservoir and then a large fish kill. The fish kill, we feel, was to do more with the sediment and the inability of the fish to be able to breathe and utilize oxygen rather than having metal contamination. Yeah.
Are you going to give us access to this report, or I'm just trying to decide how much notes to take?
Yeah, I have. So you will have this presentation, and I have a number of copies of our water quality summary, the most recent one that incorporates all of this data and information. I don't know that it specifically talks about the number of fish or the number of cubic yards.
Scott, could you email me the PowerPoint?
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay, so just a couple quick pictures that kind of characterize what we're seeing. When we drove up to do the monitoring on the 23rd, this was the site above Tibble Fork where the bridge crosses to go into Mill Hollow, and this is what kind of general water quality conditions look like. So clean gravels and cobbles, cold, clear water. No impacts, obviously, from the sediment. Compared to the downstream, all sites that we had monitored downstream of the reservoir where there was a really, really fine, thick deposit of sediment in all the backwater areas and even some of the flowing channel, as flows dropped down, that sediment dropped out, and much of it's still present in the channel today. Obviously, the fish kill that we talked about, there's Division of Wildlife Resources did all the work on characterizing the fish kill and providing those estimates. Just some photos that we observed as we were out on that day. And then the most striking, I think, is the photo of the lake bed itself. As you go up, and we were there when one of the track hosts was down in the channel working, and just visual estimates, you know, about 10 to 15 feet of sheer vertical banks from the sediment. And what was obvious when we were there is that you could see the channel kind of head cutting up into that sediment and remobilizing new sediment. That change in elevation, it takes a while for those stream gradients to stabilize. And then also the calving walls of sediment coming in from the reservoir, contributing to the turbidity in the sediment that was released. So like I mentioned, we were notified on the 23rd, coordinated with a number of agencies, including the Park Service, Forest Service.
Yeah, so just a question on that last slide. It's my understanding that they initially, with this project, looked at removing all that sediment, decided it was too expensive? or too hazardous to try to move all that sediment from the
So lake? I think it may have been a combination of both. I'm not the one to speak on what their deciding factors were, but the Natural Resources Conservation Service, the NRCS, was a consulting agency with the irrigation company and provided all the engineering and designs. And a part of that was to go through an environmental assessment process and try to assign some risk with a number of different alternatives. So one alternative was to remove the sediment, and that would gain back some of the reservoir storage, right? But they determined that the risk of removing that for remobilizing some of those metals downstream was too great, and they decided to keep that in place. So they did identify through their sampling some high metal concentrations. They didn't assign much risk with it based on the values that they were comparing, but they were able to notice or observe metals in those sediments and determine the best option was to leave it there. So it wasn't intentional to do this. Their plan was just to leave it alone and then add their new storage in by building the reservoir dam a little higher.
Yeah, I wonder if in hindsight that was the wrong decision and they might have avoided some of this trouble if they had just taken it out.
I don't know. Okay, so we had partnered with a couple agencies, Forest Service, Park Service. We did some monitoring. The Park Service is actually out a day before us because their park office is right there. We weren't notified until the 23rd and went out as soon as we could. Wildlife Resources for the fish monitoring, and then a really big partnership with the Utah County Health Department and the State Health Department for helping us develop some recreational hazard screening values to be able to get at what the risk for sediment and water exposure would be to your average recreationist. Okay, and then we worked with the contractor to build a bypass channel so that the water coming into the reservoir was put in this channel and not interacting with those lake bed sediments, and then diverted right around to the outlet works so there was less interaction and less potential for increased turbidity and sediment being transported downstream. So here's a picture of that bypass canal. It worked really well. It took them a few days to put it in. Turbidity dropped pretty quickly right after they got it in. So our sampling locations, this map's really difficult to see. Apologize for that. So in the lower left-hand corner, that's the mouth of the canyon. We had a long-term established site there. We visited that site for water chemistry and sediment monitoring. We partnered, like I mentioned, with the Park Service at the Cave Camp Springs. We had a site on the North Fork, just above the South Fork confluence. And this is right where the road to Tibble Fork departs from SR-92. We had a site right below Tibble Fork Reservoir and then above the reservoir, like we mentioned earlier.
Do you know which day that diversion actually took place?
Which day?
Yeah.
I knew you were going to ask that question.
Yeah, it was
just
5 days after.
I think so.
It took a while.
Yeah,
I remember going down on the 27th, and it was still going right down the middle. So it must have been shortly thereafter.
We were up there the 23rd, and it wasn't until the 24th that the decision was made. Mm-hmm. By the 25th, they started, and then I think it was the 27th was the weekend.
Yeah, that was the same when I saw it.
And it was after that, I think, maybe by Monday, which would have been the 29th-ish. Does that sound reasonable? We can get you some dates if you need. We had two additional monitoring locations. We were interested in seeing what the background conditions would be. So we had a site on Deer Creek, which flows into Tibble Fork Reservoir. It's above the reservoir. And then on the South Fork near Mutual Dell, and we did water and sediment monitoring there. So like I mentioned, we did our monitoring for about 2 weeks after, into mid-September, I believe. Looked at total and dissolved metals for water chemistry, sediment samples for total metals, and then compared those against some screening values, which are a combination of values that were given to us by the Public Health Department and our water quality standards. And then one of the big things that we looked at, one of the easiest analyses we can do, turbidity in dissolved solids, suspended solids. Turbidity was important to us because it was really one of the only parameters that we had in their permit to assess for their construction. They have a turbidity standard, and they're only allowed to go up a certain amount. And after that, they're susceptible to some kind of violations as a result of that. And Kim will talk about that as we get a little farther along. So here's that turbidity graph with a number of days or the different days in different colors, and in each block is a different site. So on the left, it almost looks like that above the reservoir there was no turbidity. The values are less than 0.5, so NTUs, compared to values that below the dam that are above 100 and get above 300 as you move down canyon. What was interesting is the variability from day to day, different water fluctuations, and then also from place to place when we saw the amount of sediment deposited. So we think stream gradient had a lot to do with where stuff was mobilized and transported to. So lower stream gradient, you'd have more deposition, higher stream gradient would be flushed through. So it was really hard to get some kind of a trend, but generally you can see that turbidity went way up and then eventually trailed off towards your latter sampling on September 6th, where it was pretty low. Similar thing with total suspended solids. We were interested in total suspended solids because sometimes they correlate pretty well with metals concentrations. So this is a recreational screening table. The way you'd read this is any green colored cell means that we didn't violate the recreational screening value. Any orange cell means that you would violate it. So this is for water chemistry, so a water sample. And this is for the recreational value. And these are the values that the health department generated for us because we don't have standards for these. And we saw that our water chemistry for recreational, we didn't have any violations of the screening value, so we felt pretty confident that there wasn't much risk for recreational contact, you know, causing detrimental impacts to a recreationist.
What do the white cells mean?
I'm sorry?
What are the white cells?
The white cells are, so for iron there in the middle, it just means we don't have a value for it. And then the ones that have an NS means that we didn't have a sample for that parameter on that particular day. So other water chemistry screening tables, we had one for the agricultural use, looking at whether or not it was safe for stock watering and irrigation, and we didn't have exceedances for water chemistry on those. And the same was true for the aquatic life uses. So for the cold water fishery, we didn't see water chemistry. It is important to note that when you look at these, and if you can see those numbers, which is very hard to do, as time goes on, those concentrations drop off pretty significantly, and we feel that we missed the worst case scenario in our monitoring where we were out on the 23rd and not on the 22nd when the release happened. This particular graph here shows sediment samples. So when we went out on our monitoring routine, we looked and targeted recently deposited sediments that were obviously deposited from the release, scooped those up into a jar and send them off to a lab for analysis. And in general, for the recreational, it doesn't say it up there, but this is a recreation screening table. In general, most metals, we were okay, but at two sites on, I think got these on the same day, it's hard to see, but at two different sites, we had violations for lead. So the health department responded in issuing public announcement warning the public to not touch the sediments for some level of risk due to lead exposure. So sediment samples, we compared them also against aquatic life screening values. And again, these are we borrowed these from the Environmental Protection Agency. We compiled these as a result of the Gold King mine spill. Some of the other screening values were borrowed from that as well. And what we see is a lot of metals at all sites are relatively elevated and posing some risk to aquatic life. What's important to note is our first site right here. This is above Table Fork Reservoir. And so we have some exceedances of those aquatic life screening values in the sediments above the reservoir. But as you go downstream in the reservoir, those concentrations go up significantly. So sampling conclusions, water column exceedances didn't really occur for the agricultural aquatic life and the recreational uses. Turbidity and TSS responded. It went up and returned to normal after a few weeks. The bypass canal was a really crucial part of lowering those sediment concentrations. And then those aquatic life screening values in the sediment above the dam, I think, are pretty important. And like I mentioned, values below reservoir were 2 to 7 times higher, quite a bit higher than above the reservoir for those sediments. Okay, so I'll let Kim come up and talk about this next slide.
Great. Well, my name is Kim Shelley. I manage the surface water permitting program for the state, and that also includes spills and enforcement. So that's my involvement. As you know, we issued a notice of violation to the Conservancy District for the release of sediment into American Fork River. And there were violations that were cited, as Scott mentioned, not for water quality violations per se, but for the narrative standard. So we have a narrative standard in our rules which states that you can't discharge any pollutant that might cause or contribute to a violation of water quality standards, or that might, how to exactly phrase it, it's a paragraph long, so we'll try to paraphrase it into you can't basically discharge anything that would produce conditions that aren't really conducive to aquatic life. So in this case, with the fish kill, over 5,000 trout were killed. That's a clear violation of our narrative standard. So it's one of those things where you know it when you see it. So we had the notice of violation that was issued on September 28th. We also spent close to $100,000 in monitoring costs and staff time that will be recovered as part of our action. Part of the settlement process will likely include a penalty. We have a penalty policy for our division, which allows us to assess fines up to $10,000 per day per violation. We had about six violations for about 9 days. And so we're working with the district right now to settle this action. Part of the NOV required them to come immediately into compliance, which they did. The second part of the settlement agreement will require them to continue monitoring and remove all of the sediment that's been identified in the stream banks and the canals. So it's going to be a big, big ongoing project through the spring, but we're encouraged. They seem to be willing to come to the table with us and work with us to develop a plan to move forward.
I'm sorry, I can't believe who was they?
I'm sorry, it's the Northern Utah
County
Water Conservancy District. Thank you. Oh, there we go. And part of this process is we will public notice the settlement agreement for 30 days, so you'll have an opportunity to review that and comment if you'd like. We'd be happy to send it to the mayor as well, so you're aware when that goes out for public comment. So are there any questions on the enforcement action?
Well, is North Utah Water Conservation or Water Conservancy District, are they a government entity, quasi?
That's a good question. So we asked them to provide some documentation on that. They're a quasi-government agency. Yeah. So, really, we don't have anything in our rules that would preclude us from taking action against another government agency.
That's what I was wondering. I mean, it's just basically Rob Peter, pay Paul.
Yeah, exactly. And I do want to point out that any fines that are collected do go into the state general fund, not into the Division of Water Quality's budget. So we don't benefit at all.
They couldn't come to Cedar Hills, could they?
We do fund them with our property taxes.
Oh, well, so there you go.
Any increased fines will probably just come right back out of
them. Well, we're hoping to have good insurance as well.
We do fund them through property taxes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Great. Any other questions before I hand it back to Scott?
Thank you. So part of that settlement agreement, we're asking them to come up with a monitoring plan for essentially the next 5 years to look at the overall impacts to the American Fork River drainage and to the downstream water users. So how much of that was distributed into canals, into the secondary system here, and what is the risk for that? So they're retaining a contractor to develop a comprehensive monitoring plan as part of our agreement. And we have some recommendations for them on sediment monitoring, macroinvertebrate monitoring, fish, water chemistry, and then we expect them to be able to monitor and demonstrate full cleanup of this when they're finished. So that'll all be part of their monitoring plan. Okay, so for the Snowbird project, so our involvement is kind of two phases. They reached out to us when they were developing a monitoring plan as a result of their Board of Adjustments edict, where they were mandated to develop a monitoring plan and do monitoring for a number of years. for their project. So we've been involved in providing some guidance and reviewing the monitoring plan. They had a reputable consultant develop that monitoring plan. We've had some input on how they go about doing the metal sampling, where the site should be, overlapping those where we have insufficient data, like we talked about before, making sure they are incorporating macroinvertebrate or aquatic life monitoring as part of their program. Some measure of quality assurance, so any good monitoring program needs to meet, we'll have a quality assurance program so that we can use that data for future assessments. And then for Kim's program, they're actually applying our next slide for a permit from our office for a discharge permit to cover some of their monitoring. And then we intend to use their data for future assessments and characterization of water quality in the canyon.
Chris, last time you'll probably hear from me. I also want to introduce, while I have the opportunity, Kate Johnson, who's the source water protection manager for the Division of Drinking Water, so she can now answer specific questions about drinking water. So the involvement with DWQ as far as the Snowbird expansion is twofold. We've requested, and Snowbird has applied for, a UPDS permit, and that means that they are saying that we agree that we have a discharge from our property through the Mary Ellen Gulch, and we are willing to fall under conditions that would require monitoring, reporting, and potentially effluent limits, which may be treatment down the road. We haven't gotten to that point yet. The application was received on October 5th of 2016, and we're currently in the process. It typically takes 180 days for us to process this application and develop the modeling to determine the effluent limits if necessary. That also goes through a public comment process, and we'd be happy to share it with the mayor as well when that goes out for public comment. The second area where the UPDES section is involved is a construction stormwater permitting. So this is a little different in that Utah County will be the primary control authority, but Snowbird is required to apply for a permit from the Division of Water Quality. So because they're disturbing greater than 1 acre of land, they will have to apply for this permit. That permit requires them to put in BMPs in place, best management practices, to control any runoff and to minimize pollutants that are discharged into the receiving water. Utah County and the Division will oversight this project jointly, but Utah County has the lead. Utah County will ultimately review and approve their stormwater pollution prevention plan and conduct site inspections every 2 weeks of the facility to make sure that they're adhering to their SWIP.
Any questions on the Snowbird stuff? I think that's the extent of our involvement with the project so far.
So I've heard worries from some people that they're disturbing mine tailings up in the canyon. There's worries that the Yankee mine, which was just plugged and not really cleaned up, they're worried that there could be a disaster there, like the recent other mine flood disaster. Is there anything that you have on those concerns?
I'm sorry, I missed that last part.
Is there input that you have on those concerns?
When we get into the CERCLA part, that'll be something that the EPA is going to be looking at. You know, we were up and toured with Snowbird, and as part of this determination for the UPDS permit, and just to kind of evaluate their site conditions. They are trying to do things like this particular culvert here comes out of the Live Yankee mine, and it was put in place a long time ago to divert the water across the road so that folks weren't driving through it. Because when they drive through it, it rechannels as part of the OHV network up there. It rechannels the water, and then it flows down across their tailings. And by having this pipe here, they can route the water around the tailings. So part of what they were asking us to consider is, you know, do we need to have a permit to re-implement this pipe? We didn't think that they did. The reason that the pipe failed is there was some bentonite in the soil there, and then they had a little bit of a slope collapse, and it just kind of plugged the pipe up in their collection box. So they're planning to reopen that, I believe, at some point, and then reroute that water down through that pipe and skirt around those tailings so that they don't have that problem.
Yeah, so is there a danger of disturbances to the Yankee mine and having a spill there?
I don't know. That's something that the EPA will be looking at. It's something that, you know, was brought to our attention by some of the local citizens and some of their petition. So I'll go right into that. So some citizens representing Protect and Preserve American Fork Canyon, their local advocacy group with interests in American Fork, and they have had many of these similar questions. Probably read about them in the paper, and we've had some interactions with them on some of these. But yeah, they're looking at our, you know, the impacts of the mine tunnel. So they wrote EPA a number of letters saying, would you mind taking a look at this? We're concerned that there is water quality implications affecting the beneficial uses. There could be potential human exposure. And then is there, you know, please evaluate if there is a risk to have another Gold King mine, like we had a couple of last year down in the San Juans out of Silverton, Colorado. So the EPA has recently made a determination. They sent us and Mark Allen a letter last month, I believe, well, October now, saying that they are going to initiate a preliminary assessment and then to investigate all those things. So is there a risk? What are the pathways? So is it human exposure? Is it people eating fish? Is it irrigated crops? They'll be looking at some of those. They're pretty clear that you know, they're not considering the impacts of the Tibble Fork sediment being distributed downstream from the release. I think they will be considering future sediment being stored in the reservoir, but I'm not exactly sure on that one. And then, you know, kind of the process, so they're starting here in the middle on this little red circle is this preliminary assessment. And so the process can go a number of ways. Is they find no further Superfund assessment needed, okay, or they refer it to another one of their environmental programs. I'm not sure how they make that determination. But if they find that there is some risk and some of these pathways and some of these conditions are met, they'll move it into the next category, which is a site inspection. Similar kind of pathway. And if that site inspection passes their threshold, they'll develop a hazard ranking for it. And if the hazard ranking is above a certain threshold, then that puts it into the Superfund category where it would be eligible for federal funding for mine cleanup. So that's that process is just beginning. Our Division of Emergency Response and Remediation is partnered to that, as well as Division of Water Quality. So EPA will be consulting with us. Like I mentioned, their whole thing here is an evaluation of existing information. So they're not doing additional monitoring or additional field investigations. They plan to come out next year when the snow's off, take a tour around the canyon, get input from us, and then collect all the documents and information that are available for the project and use that as a starting point. I guess with that, we'll take
Councilors, I have a couple of minutes. Does anyone have any closing questions?
Thank you.
As soon as I get the PowerPoints from Scott and Kim, then I'll circulate them to the council.
Okay. Perfect.
Thank you so much for coming
out,
guys.
Appreciate the time. Thank you.
Okay, council, I do want to give you a break. However, Mr. Shaw and I need to go into exec session with you for just a brief couple of minutes. So someone would like to make a motion pursuant to the state codes to discuss the purchase, exchange, or lease of real property, and discuss also potential or imminent litigation. And that's what we need to discuss.
Mayor, I move that we go into closed session pursuant to Utah State Code 52-4-204 and 52-4-205, 1D and E, to discuss the purchase, exchange, or lease of real property, and to discuss the sale of real property, and to discuss pending litigation here in the basement of our community recreation center.
Thank you very much. I have a motion.
Second.
Motion's been seconded. I think everyone needs to vote. So, Mr. Cipolla?
Aye.
Mrs. Reese?
Aye.
Mr. Bailey?
Aye.
Mr. Crawley?
Aye.
Mr. Geddes?
Aye.
Motion was unanimous. Thank you very much. We will excuse all those that don't need to be here. We'll let our friends in PDQ grab.